Welcome to the Mom Forum. I am your host, Alicia Wilson Beach. I am birth mom of three, adoptive mom of one, and stepmom to four. Yes, you counted that right. That is eight kids. And over the years, I have been known to completely overshare my story of motherhood. And I started this podcast to be able to share the common and maybe not so common experiences of motherhood from women of all walks of life. So thank you for joining me for these intimate mom-to-mom conversations following each of my guests' journey through motherhood. These stories are honest and vulnerable. There's a little bit of humor and a whole lot of relatability. And my hope is that you can see yourself in one of these stories and know that you are absolutely not alone in this crazy journey through motherhood. I am so happy to have you as a listener of the Mom Forum podcast. And if you would like to further support us, you can become a patron of ours. Just visit us at patreon.com/themomforum, and you can support us with a monthly subscription at the $3 level, $5, or $7. It's just a tiny monthly payment that will add up to a ton of support here for the work that we do at the Mom Forum. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and please share these episodes. And if you could take a moment, we would love to hear a review and your thoughts on the Mom Forum podcast. I am sitting down with Hunter Clark Fields. She is a mindfulness mentor, author of the book Raising Good Humans, which we have provided the link for you in the show notes, so be sure to click on that and go check it out. She's also the host of the Mindful Mama podcast, where she has some amazing guests with tons and tons of lessons. And she is the creator of the Mindful Parenting membership. And she and I have one of the most honest, open conversations that I've ever heard about practicing mindfulness in the reality of being a mom. And she shares about her struggles with having a temper and how she actually uses her practice and what that really looks like in real life. And trust me, it's not the clear mind, fabulous, meditating, calm mama that you may think. And I was so validated by this conversation and learned so many good tidbits of information. And I hope that you have the same experience listening to this conversation with Hunter Clark Fields. Thank you so much for joining me today, Hunter.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here with you. This is great.
Another hotel room interview. I've done a few of these before.
Welcome to my hotel room.
The glamour of it all. And I always ask my guests who they are a mom to.
I am a mom to my daughters, two daughters, Maggie, who's 12, and Sora, who's 9.
And we ran into each other at a Mom 2.0 event, and I think someone pulled the two of us together because they knew we were both big-time self-care pushers.
Take the self-care! Take it together!
You two must meet each other! And this is kind of a new journey for me, and I've been sharing it as I've been learning, but I think you've been on it a little bit longer, and you're now a coach, a mindful mama coach. And when did the mindfulness as a practice start for you?
It started for me kind of in two points. Mm-hmm. When I was a teenager, I started like reading and learning about mindfulness because wow. I was a really like highly sensitive person, like really intense kid. Mm-hmm. And I would get like fall into these pits of depression very regularly, like every like week or two. You know, and just, you know, my dad is very similar, and he was like, this is just your artistic temperament, and this is how life will be for you. And I was like, okay, great, this is like not working for me. I need to like find some ways to deal with it. And so I started reading about mindfulness when I was a teenager. I discovered someone who became ultimately a great teacher of mine, Thich Nhat Hanh, he's a Zen Buddhist monk. He's in his 90s now, but he was a big peace activist in the 70s. In fact, Martin Luther King nominated him for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I discovered those readings. I started reading, and just the reading made me feel so much better. But then it really actually took me a decade of reading about mindfulness before I was able to actually sit down and do a mindfulness meditation practice and have a regular practice in my life. And, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, lo and behold, doing the thing actually works a lot better than reading about it. And for me, like those dips, right? I had really felt like I couldn't handle life in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like, in those dips. And I remember I was a teacher at one point. I had panic attacks in the high school parking lot, all kinds of things like, after about 3 months of doing this steady meditation practice, which was just 10 minutes or so a day, most days, I looked back at my life and I realized that I hadn't had any of those dips that I had had for my whole life until then.
Yeah.
My whole life. And it was just such a game changer for me. I mean, it just gave me this equanimity, right? Like you've spent some time with me now. You know I'm not like a super like just chill, blissed out, naturally person. Like I've got some energy. But like this gave me this, it didn't change who I am, but it gave me this ability to like kind of like recover more quickly from stuff and not like get dragged down by
what? I'm so curious, like what made you think to read that kind of stuff as a teenager? Like I don't know a lot of teenagers that go, I want to learn about mindfulness because I'm struggling here. Like, like to be that conscious, or was it brought to your attention by somebody? Or
I don't know. I mean, my mom took me to my first yoga class when I was 17. But my parents had actually the first book I read about Buddhist meditation was like a really weird little book. It was like a little one of those like mini books of Zen koans, which are like little stories that are meant to like kind of sort of jolt you out of your everyday way of thinking, which was a very, I don't know how I got from there to the other things, but I kind of think I discovered that section in the store where I was like, at one point I discovered one of the first things that helped me. I discovered a book called Simple Abundance, and it's this like pink book and it says like a daily thing. But what I learned from Simple Abundance was to do a gratitude journal and write down every night 5 things I was grateful for. And I started to like kind of explore. I think I was just exploring in the bookstores, like what are these things that can support me and help me and explain what the heck is wrong with me.
I get it. It really blows my mind that as a teenager you were looking for that, because I don't think a lot of adults have the maturity to go, what can I do to support myself in this struggle that I'm having? And as you, you said you read it for 10 years before you were actually practicing it. So how was that? Was it playing a role in your life at all? And were you still having the panic attacks?
Yeah, I mean, how it started is that I felt I felt too restless to be able to do a sitting meditation practice.
Yeah.
And so at that time also, one of the things that, you know, I had, you know, as a teenager, that had helped me to kind of get, out of some difficult and struggling times in my life at that time, was running. I learned to run. I had a friend who was like smoking a lot and she started running and I was like, if she can do it, I can do this thing. And so I started running, and at first I would like run with like Nine Inch Nails and Wu-Tang Clan. Cassette player.
Cassette players.
And But then by the time I kind of, as I started reading about mindfulness and things like that, I started to, and I started to explore yoga a little bit more. All these things kind of happened at the same time. And then I stopped running, but listening to things. Mm-hmm. And so what I started to do is I started to like run mindfully. Like I would just pay attention to my breath and I would take yoga classes and I would run mindfully. And that was sort of this way that I could take this practice of paying attention to the present moment, not always distracting oneself, trying, you know, be developing more self-awareness. And I kind of moved it from these sort of moving practices to eventually being able to sit. Not surprisingly, but because it was the same for me, but it's very scary for us to just sit down by ourselves and do nothing. There's actually this study they did where they sat people in a room for 15 minutes. And the only thing that they could do, they could either just do nothing or they could press a little button that gave them an electric shock. And like 85% of people gave themselves shocks. Like, it's like, just...
That's better than nothing.
So we have this real... And I think that just comes from our, you know, our survival instinct mm-hmm. and things like that. But it is kind of like this cool... I kind of think of it as this cool brain hack, right? Like that if we sit, even with the feeling of like, oh, it's weird to sit by myself and do nothing, and what do I do with myself? And we practice to focus on the present moment with some sort of anchor. It's like this brain hack, right? You get more peace, more well-being, mm-hmm. better sleep, all those benefits.
Yeah. When I think that I was listening to this podcast, I don't remember where, about meditation. And one of the things that flipped the switch for me was him saying that meditation was not the idea of you humming and humming in your position, the lotus position.
You don't need to have your hands like this.
Yes. But that it was really just about being present in the actual moment. So mm-hmm. like if you're in the shower, you're in the shower. You're not going, okay, when I get out of the shower, I can do this, this, this. So that mm-hmm. running was actual meditation, and you were practicing the skill that you thought you weren't able to do.
Yeah.
And then you were able to transfer it to actually being physically still.
Yeah. I had done a yoga teacher training, and she kind of introduced us to meditation in a little bit of a weird way. Over our month-long intensive, she had us meditate with like almost zero instruction for like a half an hour. And then the next time, 2 weeks later, for an hour. And that was it. And it was like such a... it wasn't a very skillful way to introduce uh-huh. someone to meditation. Then I was kind of like, well, I could do that. I can do it for 10 minutes. You know, it's okay.
Yeah, it does. It makes a huge difference, even just 10 minutes. And then, so you've done all this reading and studying, and then you're practicing it. At what point did you start having kids? Was it a practice already in place by the time you were having children?
Yeah. I'd had my study practice for about 2 years at that point. Mm-hmm. And I remember like, I thought because I had meditation practice that I had everything figured out then. And like, I remember sitting in this meditation group that I was in, like with my big pregnant belly, and thinking, gosh, this child, she's going to be so peaceful and so awesome. Look at me, like sitting and meditating while I'm pregnant, like this is going to be amazing. And, you know, and the reality hits you. It's like really different. And of course, she is a highly sensitive person, like mm-hmm. her mama, go figure, you know, and was like really intense kid from the beginning. And so, it was kind of a shock to the system.
And when you have to parent yourself, it's that mirror of you, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to be hard. Yeah. Now, and I've heard in your podcast you saying you reached a point in your parenting where you were frustrated and yelling. And so, because I think so many people think that once you have it figured out, then you, it just flows and everything figures.
Sparkles shoot out of your nose.
And you're always calm and you can always just meditate to fix everything. Mm-hmm. What would you say was the cause of the frustration? And how did you recognize it before you knew you needed to address it differently?
Well, at first I thought the cause of my frustration was that she was saying no to me and was so difficult. And she had all these, she would have a tantrum and she would have a, you know, she was like a ticking time bomb. She would like, you know, sometimes we had big epic tantrums like 3 times a day and she was so intense. But I mean, the truth is that the cause of that was within me. And that was what I really started to see, is like kind of develop that awareness of it. And what I saw was my, you know, and I call it in some ways like my father's rage, mm-hmm. but it really wasn't his. It was his father's and mm-hmm. mother's and their parents. You know, this is not something that we need to blame ourselves for, but this rage came out in me. Like, she would have these big feelings and I would just like, it felt completely unacceptable to me. Like, it just mm-hmm. felt like this was unacceptable. And, you know, and then I would get angry. I'd get really triggered. And then I would yell. And I could see I was scaring her. I'm like, I was scaring her just the way my father scared me. And I could really see this pattern. It was so clear to me that, like this, it was, this felt so unacceptable to me because, you know, the message I was given very loud and clearly when I was a little kid was that it was unacceptable for me to have these big feelings mm-hmm. because it triggered all this anger in my father, especially in my mom sometimes too. And so, you know, so then it felt unacceptable to me and I responded the same exact way. Like, there was this threat happening and I would just feel all this anger. And it felt, in those moments, it felt really, I felt an incredible sense of shame. Mm-hmm. You know, I was so disappointed in myself. I remember crying on the floor, just calling myself a terrible mother. And that's not that helpful, ultimately. Like, it leaves you feeling helpless and that doesn't work. And so really, I could only see at this point, like, okay, what can I learn from this? What do I have to learn from this? Mm-hmm. What is going on? So I really like dove back into my mindfulness practice, tried to make it even more steady, worked even more on my self-care, taking time for myself for you, taking time away from you for you so mm-hmm. that I can be a better parent to you. Doing all those things, working to really calm my reactivity, which helped. It worked bit by bit, slowly, over time. It wasn't like a magic, you know, pill. But, and for me, it was interesting because then I saw, like, okay, I'm able to sort of like calm myself down. But then, you know, then I would say something that like my parents might have said to me when I was little that was unskillful and wasn't very, and that she would have all this resistance to because she's highly sensitive, and that it would be like, you know, a whole like explosion all over again. And so I really saw that, like, okay, these are these two things we need, right? Like, not only do I need to like work on myself, calm myself down, work on, you know, that self-compassion piece, you know, offering myself that soft landing so that I can practice to make changes and grow and learn. But I also need to figure out, what the heck do I say to this child too, you know? So there was a whole lot of learning. I mean, it was really an intensive time for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, that rage piece is so, it rings so true for me too. And you just don't hear moms talk about that. Mm-hmm. If we consider it taboo or not how you're supposed to feel, like, how could you feel rageful towards this child of yours? And I think so many of us feel shame around it. Mm-hmm. And so then maybe we don't address it or deal with what is actually going on that's bringing on that rage.
Just make it go away. This is not me, right?
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, part of the work that I had done when I was younger, right? You were saying, like, how did I look at mindfulness as a young person? And part of what I did when I was younger is, like, as a an artist, actually, is like I looked at, I wasn't able to, as a sort of highly sensitive person, I wasn't able to kind of like block off these parts of myself I didn't want to see. Mm-hmm. I really felt everything. I really saw everything. And I, what I think maybe led up for me to be able to deal with that situation of this rage coming out more skillfully was that I had been looking at these pieces, even in pregnancy, of like, oh, like I have, you know, I have like I'm a mammal, right? Like I'm like, I'm like a predator in some ways. Like I'm like a, you know, I have aggression in me. Yeah. I have, you know, I have this, I really want to eat meat now that I'm pregnant.
Yeah,
which I didn't want to do because of moral reasons, right? But I needed, you know, I kind of had to come to terms with, I think, that there's all these parts of ourselves that we think we can't look at. But actually, I think looking at all those parts of ourselves are like what give us the most, like, meaning and ability to just connect and be really real with each other.
Yeah, it's very true. But and I, you know, I just want to take a big step back because we're using the word mindful, and that's
we should do
the yes, you're the mindful mama, and some people are listening to this going, what in the world does that mean? So what does being mindful mean for you, the practice of that?
Yeah, I mean, well, it means just to, you know, it means to be intentionally practiced, to be present, to be in the present moment with your, all of you, your mind, your heart, and your soul, and your body, all together in the present moment with a sense of kindness and curiosity. And when you say that, we have to kind of define, because many of us don't realize what kind of our normal untrained mind state is. And mm-hmm. that state is that, you know, we're thinking 80,000, you know, okay, and mindfulness is not about stopping thoughts. I will just say that as well. So thoughts are something that arise in the present moment too. But one of the things that take us out of the present moment is like we're often, you know, future projecting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really most often what we're doing. We're thinking, you know, 90,000 thoughts a day, 80,000 of which we thought yesterday. I mean, literally, they've done studies on this. Mm-hmm. You know, like I might be a little off on the numbers, but we are kind of by nature, but you know, just by the way we are, we're wired for survival. So we're planning and doing sort of the next things and the next things and the next things. And we're always in our heads, we're like going to get to some point where then we can kind of like stop and be present. And, but then when we've practiced to, you know, to be always in the future, then we get to that place and we can't be present. Mm-hmm. It's just hard. It's a muscle that you have to build. And so that's what mindfulness really is like building that muscle of being in the present moment. And it's really often mundane and simple and not very exciting and blissful. And there aren't sparkles coming out of one's nose at all. And sometimes it's really uncomfortable too. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But building that tolerance for even the discomfort is what allows us that's that mindfulness muscle that it allows us to be present for all the things, like our children, right? To be actually in the present moment with them. That's the only place we can be with them and love them and see them really for who they are is when we're really there.
Yeah. And now, as a mom, some of us, our brains just never stop. And it is a hard thing to get into the practice of slowing down and stopping and giving us ourselves those moments to actually be there and not go through the list of the 50 things we have to do before the kids, when the kids go to bed, as we're getting them ready for bed. So what is the actual practice, the things that you do on a daily basis that help you to, quote unquote, build that muscle and to actually be present?
Yeah, well, I mean, and you were right, absolutely, in saying when I was running, right, I was doing that practice. And you can practice you can do mindful interviewing, mindful walking, and mindful dishwashing. And there's all these wonderful ways that you can practice really be present, really being present. Like one way I think is wonderful to practice is to just sometimes when you're walking from one place to your car, to just slow down and just walk to the car slowly to give ourselves a little pause in place. But I personally believe that it's very helpful, if not really necessary, if you're wanting to build that muscle, to have some kind of formal time in your day where you're just putting aside and saying, this is the time where I'm going to practice training my mind to be present. And for that's what meditation can be, like a mindfulness meditation. And it can be sitting and it can be walking and things like that. But it really does help to say, okay, every day when I wake up or every day during nap time or whatever it is, I'm just going to set my timer for 3 minutes or use a guided meditation. I'm going to use that time to practice being present. And I believe that formal time to practice is important because then you're never going to remember to practice all the other times if you don't have some kind of anchor throughout your day that's saying, this is important to me. I set the intention to be present, and that's what that looks like. For me, it looks like a morning meditation practice.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Mom Self-Care Planner. As a mother, you take on a ton of roles. Mom, taxi driver, cook, housekeeper, activities coordinator, holiday planner, house manager, wife, lover, employee, caretaker, the list just goes on. And balancing all the roles that come along with motherhood can be overwhelming. And the next thing you know, there is no room on the to-do list for you. But mamas, we have got to prioritize our self-care or we become burned out, stressed out, and completely overwhelmed. But that is not easy when you are a mama. It takes a little bit of planning and a little bit of work. And the Mom Self-Care Planner is designed to walk you through creating a personal plan for the daily practice of your self-care to support you in your mental, spiritual, social, physical, and emotional health. This will help you better manage your stress levels, feel less overwhelmed, be more resilient when those kiddos are driving you nuts, and leave you as a happier and healthier mom. So get your Mom Self-Care Planner today. Click on the link in our show notes. And as a listener, just type podcast into the discount code and you will get 10% off your purchase.
So I think when so many people hear the word be present and they think about meditation, they have these unrealistic ideas that they can sit in silence and no thoughts will come in their heads. And like, that's the expectation they place on themselves. So when that's not what happens, they're like, this doesn't work for me. So what does being present mean?
That's a really good question. And, you know, actually, it's wonderful what you described. In the mindfulness world, they have a word for that, and it's called noble failure. Because everybody goes through that, not being able to, no one can stop their thoughts, really. You're like dead, or I don't know what's happened to you, but When you sit in that practice of, you know, maybe you're sitting and you use something to anchor yourself in the present moment. So maybe it's the breath and you're trying to pay attention to the feeling of the breath coming in. Feel it come in through your nose and feeling the breath come out. Maybe feeling it in your chest. You know, so you're paying attention to the physical sensations. You're literally coming to your senses and you're taking your attention and kind of training it like a spotlight into this feeling, right? So maybe you can put your hand on your belly and you can feel the breath. I breathe in as the belly comes out and exhale and feel the belly soften a little. And when that happens and you try to put your attention on there, if you do that for more than just like one breath, if you get aim for like the big old goal of three breaths, you're gonna have, your mind's gonna wander somewhere. And say you try practice to do that for 5 minutes, your mind's gonna wander like 60,000 times. It's just gonna go off and go off and go off. And the practice, when you're doing that sort of rep of like kind of like building that muscle, is when you notice, oh, I've been thinking about what I'm gonna make for dinner for like the last however many minutes. I was supposed thought I was supposed to be doing this meditation thing, and you say, oh, okay. And then with kindness and curiosity, so without judging yourself and with a sense of kindness, you say, okay, what was I doing? I was feeling the breath. So you come back and you feel the breath. And every time you notice you're distracted, that's like a great moment. It's like two thumbs up, because then you're coming back to the present moment. And really, like, when I first started practicing, I thought I was just sitting there. Like, I remember looking back, I'm just sitting here and like thinking the whole time, like, this is ridiculous. But that's when I saw that I hadn't had any of those dips, like, it was really working. You don't look at, you know, whether your mind is as still as a clear pool of water to see whether your meditation practice is working. You can just kind of look at how you feel in your daily life. And sometimes my clients tell me their partners notice first, like, oh, you've been very like calm lately, you know. They'll notice first, which I think is really interesting. But during that time of practice, you'll be very distracted. You might have anxiety arise, other feelings, all kinds of things will arise, and we practice in that moment to just stay non-reactive and just observe, to just bring this attitude of kindness and curiosity to all of those things that are arising. And then when we want to be with our child and they might be having a hard time, or maybe they're just excited, or maybe they're blathering on about Candyland and hate Candyland, you can practice to notice, oh, there's that thought of I hate Candyland. Okay, I'm going to come back to my body. I'm going to listen to the words. I'm going to look at their face. I'm going to use these things to bring me back into the present moment rather than into the like the commentary about it.
Yeah, I think that clears it up, because learning that changed how I was approaching my practice too, because it's this weird expectation. I have no idea where it comes from, that that's how it's supposed to happen.
Yeah, you're just going to be like blissful, and you're going to have like a clear mind. And you know, sometimes that happens, like when you pay attention to the present moment, sometimes that does happen. I was sitting, but let me share this story. So I was sitting in a meditation group that was affiliated with the monastery of Thich Nhat Hanh, actually. Mm-hmm. And one time a monk came down and he sat with us. And so in this group, we sat for, we did 25 minutes of sitting meditation, 10 minutes of walking meditation, and then 10 minutes of sitting meditation. And after that, we had a discussion, Dharma discussion. And he shared during the discussion part, he said, well, during this period of meditation, it felt like it was very, you know, he said, I felt like I had about 2 minutes of really nice clarity. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is your full-time job. And you had, oh, okay. It's really, really okay that my mind wanders as much as it does. Like, it's really, really okay.
That is what's gonna happen.
It's like, you know, the ears hear things, the mind thinks things. We're not going to shut off our ears, and we're not going to shut off our minds. And that's okay. It's just building a muscle to be able to be present when we want to.
Yeah. And you said that you had this practice, and then your child came along, and she is the highly sensitive, the same version of you. Have you been able to teach this in your child? And how have you passed this practice on to your child, if you have?
Well, when one's mother teaches mindfulness, that's kind of the, like, you're just like, oh gosh, eye roll. That's what mom does. And so they resisted. I did not push it on them at all. I do believe in modeling and that example. So they would see me meditate every morning. So I don't push it on them at all. And I every so often I'd say, hey, do you want me to teach you how to meditate? You know, because now my oldest daughter is 12. No. I really think my 9-year-old could really benefit. No. I really think they need to maybe do it at school where it's a whole group of them or something like that. But the ways we have supported their learning about that is that living by example, like practicing to show them my meditation practice, show them we have a screen-free Sunday, practicing late ways like that. But we've also taken them on a couple of family retreats, mm-hmm. family mindfulness retreats for like a week. Uh-huh. And so they meet other families and they get like instruction with other kids mm-hmm. whose parents are doing this crazy weird meditation thing. But anyway, so they've had some experience that way too, and they love it and they really want to go back. And it's interesting because it's a whole week where there's zero screens and zero phones and, you know, some monks and nuns teaching them about peeling an orange very slowly and sniffing that orange and practicing mindful eating and singing funny songs. And they love it. It just is like, it's very nurturing to come to be in. It's really nurturing to take a break from our distracted world. Yeah.
Oh, the screen-free Sundays. I think I'm going to have to borrow that one. That sounds like a really good idea.
It's really nice, and it's good for me too. You know, like I run a business and I do all kinds of things, and I block out that time as a blackout. I don't check my email. I don't do, you know, I mean, I check the weather sometimes.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. I get the movie tickets. We do some things like that, but mm-hmm. we don't. And it's just like, oh, and you can notice that habit of going and wanting to distract oneself, and you just it's like it's kind of like a little check in the pace and the distractedness of your world.
Yeah. And you're a mindful mama coach and you work with other moms, and I think sometimes hearing it from the person that we think has it all together that it's like, no, this is not how it works. I'm trying to get my kids to do things they don't want to do too, and I'm constantly trying to change my practice. But when you're working with your moms, what would you say one of the biggest struggles you see a lot in the moms that you're working with?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of different struggles. I think one of the things, like the mamas who work with me, they've listened to enough of the Mindful Mama podcast. They're like, okay, Hunter is going to say you're going to do this meditation practice. And they can do it. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of surprising. Even kids with really little kids and babies, they figure out how to find 5 or 3 minutes or something mm-hmm. really small in their day. So that's actually not as like non-doable as you'd think. Yeah. It's actually much more doable. The thing I think that is harder for them in some ways is what I see is it's in some ways a symptom of this, like a sense of worthiness, a sense of like asking mm-hmm. for help, what we've talked about, right? I think asking for help and like is one of the hardest things that my clients do. Like, you know, as the coach, I have to say, you have to ask for help. I want to see that you have looked into X number of babysitters. I want you to see that you've done this by next week, you know, and it's, we have such a block against, you know, this idea that I should be able to do it all, you know, and it's so harmful. It's so harmful. We need to be able to ask for help and acknowledge that, you know, and talk to our partners and get help and, you know, acknowledge that it is not your, even if you're a stay-at-home mom, it is not your job to do all the things, you know, mm-hmm. and that is not, no one can do all the things and be a sane, happy person and do them well. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's one of the biggest hurdles, I think, for people.
What would you say your own personal biggest hurdle has been in motherhood?
Well, mine has definitely been my anger. I still have a temper. You know, it's really interesting. And it doesn't come out that often, but it's funny. Yeah, no, I was pretty good at asking for help. That was one thing I was pretty good at. But, you know, there's enough of a feminist in me that I was like, yes, you should be taking on that piano lesson, whatever it is, right? Yeah. But for me, it's interesting. I talk about my temper, I tamed it so much, and I kind of became friends and with my anger. I accept that I have this anger. So my own challenge is, but it's interesting. It comes back, you know, in different situations, trigger different things in you. We were, we had watched a movie one night. Actually, I totally shouldn't have done it, but we did it on a screen-free Sunday. We like made an exception. And then afterwards, the girls were just, you know, it was late and my youngest daughter was like, kind of like, manic and bouncy and didn't want to go to bed. And then she started laughing at me. And oh boy, just watch out. And I could just feel this like pulsing through my body. I mean, this was like a month ago. I could feel this anger coming through my body. And it's not like these things, like these things don't go away. Like we're still human. Like the Dalai Lama talks about his anger, and I just could like, the thing that's different now is that I can respond to this skillfully in a way, even when I'm like this angry. And like, instead of you, blah, 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 it's I am feeling so angry right now. I am feeling so angry. Walked outside. I was trying to like ignore her. I was like, I'm not going to give it attention. And then I was like, and then I started to get angry. And then I like walked outside. I like slammed the door. And then I took my library book and I was in the driveway. And I threw my library book on the ground. And I was like, ah! It was so funny. I hadn't been that angry in so long. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to go inside. And one of the tools for calming ourselves down is to do like something that's calming, like to put our body in that position, like a child's pose in yoga or a forward fold. So I go and I go into a child's pose and I can just feel this like pulsing, radiating like anger, like the Tasmanian devil had me. It's like, this is not working. So I left the house again. And it was like pitch black at night. And I just like started walking up and down my street because I could just feel this was like an energy that I needed to expel from my body. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I yelled. I think I screamed that I was feeling so angry, but I screamed words that were skillful. I was talking about myself, you know? Yeah,
and not taking it out on her.
And then I went and I dispelled the energy. Because what are you going to do with all that energy when a kid laughs at you?
That is me almost every night because my 13-year-old is such a prankster. And by the end of the night, I just don't have it in me anymore. And he just keeps going and going. And he always gives and he always does this little like joker smile. He looks at me like, mom. And that rage. And so you have no idea how much that story validated. Because it's like, oh my God, where is this coming from? And why does it trigger me all the time? And I've started learning to say, I'm getting really furious right now and I'm tired and I need you to go to bed because I'm going to lose it in about 5 minutes because I've asked you several times. And learning to voice it in that way as opposed to just like, there would be times that I would literally just scream so bad that I would damage my throat muscles because it was all of that. That's like the way I could do it because we don't spank our children or anything like that in our house. And so it was just the urge to get it out.
Yeah.
And it's to know that it's there, acknowledge that it's there, and to say that it's okay that I have that feeling, but to learn how to deal with it.
And that whole piece that you're describing of saying that it's okay to have the feeling, and I hope that, you know, your listener is getting this from this, is that what is of anyone else is of you. Like, this is just the full spectrum of humanity. And when we try to tell ourselves, like, a good mother would never feel that rage or have those things, like, those messages are so harmful to us, because what we resist persists, right? Mm-hmm, there's that, mm-hmm. It's like a pithy saying for a reason. And when we try to push it away, when we try not, then we're just like kicking the bucket down the road. We're not dealing with it. It's like we're just trying to push a beach ball under the water. It pops up later, even higher, even stronger in some random place. And we have to accept, like, this is the work, right? Of like that motherhood, that parenthood forces us to do, is to, in some ways, like, if we can grow from it in a real way, is to acknowledge and accept all these different parts of ourselves. And then, and what the odd thing is that as we do, as we accept all these parts of ourselves, they lose their power. You know, there's this another saying of like, you walk with your shadow in front of you, you know, and the idea is like, when your shadow is behind you, your shadow is this big, scary, horrible thing, and never look around and look at it. Oh, no. You know? Uh-huh. But if you can just say, yeah, here's my shadow. Here it is. I got this thing. And it's okay. It's part of being human. And the practice that I talk about in the book, and that is really the underlying, most foundational thing, you know, even us, with mindfulness is part of it, but is self-compassion. Mm-hmm. Because we come from a culture that's really very judgmental, very blame-oriented. It's kind of this whole, you know, puritanical whatever thing that we've been doing for a long time. But, and we think that, like, if we're hard on ourselves, if we say, oh, you're terrible, you know, if you're a terrible mother, we blame and shame and do all those things to ourselves, it'll make us become a better person. And the truth is, that is not true. No. It just doesn't work. It's ineffective. The truth is that when we can give ourselves a soft landing, when we can accept that we have all these things, they lose their power, and we can grow and change. And it really makes a lot of sense. And research backs this up. So if you think about it, right, like, you're, you know, maybe your kid is like, he's laughing at you, and you're just like, argh! And you want to work with this, right? You want to practice to, like, be better and try some new things. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that's stepping outside of your comfort zone, right? Because you're trying to grow and do something different. If you do that, and then you're an inevitable human being, and you make a mistake, which you will be, and you greet your own mistake inside yourself with words that are harsh and mean and judgmental, you leave yourself feeling helpless and incapable. And you're not going to want to step outside that comfort zone anymore, because it's so, this is like mean voice when you do, right? But if you practice self-compassion, and instead you have like you practice giving yourself kind words when you mess up, and you grow, you just do these steps, step out of your comfort zone, and then you inevitably make a mistake because you're human and you will. You greet yourself with compassion, like, oh, this is hard. This is new. This is not easy. This really brings up a lot of stuff in me, and I'm doing my best, and this is hard. We give ourselves compassion, then we are more likely to then try it again.
Yeah.
And try it again. And the research from Kristen Neff in University of Austin shows that that is true, that people who practice self-compassion can then be more successful in anything they're doing, because they're giving themselves that soft landing.
That's such great advice. And you say, you just mentioned you wrote a book.
Yes.
So talk about the book a little bit, because I think it will be a great read for a lot of mamas that are working on the mindfulness.
Well, so it's called Raising Good Humans, and it's coming. It's December, out in December 2019 for future listeners. It's all over there. And yeah, so it basically brings together these two worlds. Like when I, as I was struggling and learning, kind of took myself into trainings and all kinds of things at that time when I was really struggling, what I saw is that we really need this mindfulness, right? Because it's like this brain hack, right? And it helps us to become less reactive. And it literally changes the brain to help you access the prefrontal cortex and to actually slows down, weakens that fight, flight, or freeze stress response, right? Mm. Which keeps you from accessing the prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, that's where your verbal ability, your empathy, mm-hmm. your creativity, your problem solving, all that good stuff is there, right? So it literally works with the brain to make it more likely so that you can access all of your higher order thinking and helps us be less reactive, right? So we need that. And then the skillful communication, because what I saw, like, as I was kind of looking into these things is that the mindfulness world would say, well, just practice mindfulness, you'll be calmer and everything will be okay after that. And I did that, and then I would say something and it would be like, oh, kaboom, all over again. Mm-hmm. So, but then I would look into this parenting world. I got trained in parent effectiveness training and all kinds of communication skills. Mm-hmm. And what that world would kind of, they would kind of start with step one, pause, and then say all these skillful things. Well, there's a lot behind this step one, pause, right? like there's all this other stuff over here, you know? So what I saw is that these two worlds need to come together. Yes. And that's what Raising Good Humans does. It brings together that mindfulness, self-compassion, that work, and how to do that with the communication skills to then how to create cooperation so you don't have to use threats and punishment, and how to bring those two pieces together.
So important, because sometimes you have one piece and not the other piece, and that it's like a spiral when they don't work together.
You're like, why? Oh,
yes, that's me almost every night. Why is this not working?
It's so hard. And but the thing is like, as we practice, right, and we practice our tools to be more present, be more calm, and then we practice our communication skills, like, it's kind of like really hard. It's like learning another language. Mm-hmm. You mess up a lot, mm-hmm. and you know, all that stuff. But as we do the work up front, when we do more of the work up front, it becomes easier over time. Like it becomes snowballs to become easier over time. Whereas if we don't put as much effort up front, we use a lot of the threats and the punishment, then we always have to up those more and more. That becomes harder and harder as time goes on, where you're really kind of creating a relationship. I really think having dived into this world in a way that I have now, I really kind of think that this whole idea that we see of as adolescent rebellion, like we kind of mm-hmm. just think that's normal.
Yeah.
What I really see is that adolescents are rebelling against the destructive techniques their parents have been using, mm-hmm. not against the people themselves.
Yeah.
It's just the ways that we've done things in the past. And there are other ways, and they've been practicing for a while. Like some of the communication skills I teach are from like from parent effectiveness training that's from 1970, that book. It's mm-hmm. great. And there have been kids now who have been raised, you know, who don't rebel against their parents, you know, they want to have autonomy and things like that, but it's not like, you know, not like, I guess me when I was a teenager.
Hey, every kid has their own journey. Like even as true. I've watched my stepkids, they were each very, very different in going through those quote unquote teen rebellion years. And so it's like that learning that mindfulness so you can actually be in the moment with the child that you're with and be mm-hmm. aware of both your needs and their needs is such a demanding practice. And to hear someone that does do this as a living, hear them have the same struggles as you, is like, oh, okay. this is hard. I'm not doing it wrong. Thank you.
And you will mess up a lot. I still mess up a lot. Yeah. I mean, I still do. I say unskillful things. Now, sometimes I say, I really want to threaten you right now.
Just voicing the feeling.
I really want to threaten you right now.
But it's true. It's like you have to give yourself that grace and know mm-hmm. that we have these expectations of ourselves that are just not realistic.
No, it's true. Like, we are gonna make mistakes. We're gonna mess up. You know, I mean, there's no such thing as perfect. It's just like such a harmful idea. You know, we can't do it perfectly. Our kids are gonna have their own weird quirks and things. And the truth is, we can't control our kids. You know, they're not little puppets to be controlled. Even when they're like 2 years old,
yeah,
they're showing you that, you know, you're not. I love, I've had a guest on my podcast, Hal Runkle, and he wrote this wonderful book called The Scream-Free Parent. And he says it in a really beautiful way. He says, you're not responsible for your kids because they're making their own decisions. Mm-hmm. You're not responsible for what they are making independent decisions. But you are responsible to your kids. Mm-hmm. You are responsible for how you show up to this relationship. And that's kind of what this kind of points to. Is like, here's how to show up as a person who is responsible for your own feelings and a person who's responsible for your own reactions. And first of all, that's responsible for your own words and not just being driven by autopilot, mm-hmm. right? And that's the idea, is that we're, you know, if we don't practice in some way and do some work in some way, we're just autopilot regurgitating what our parents did for us or what we hear in the culture or we're just driven by that stress response or that reactivity. And we want to be able to take responsibility for how we show up. And yeah.
Such great advice. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. And tell us, we're going to link your book so all of us can get your book, and tell us where we can find you.
You can find me at mindfulmamamentor.com, and the Mindful Mama podcast is there, and Raising Good Humans is there too. So mindfulmamamentor.com. Thank you, Alicia. This is so fun. You do such incredible work. I'm so pleased we can connect and that we need these voices, right? Like, yes. We need them. And thank you for being real too.
Oh, thank you. I love it. We'll see. We have to figure something out between the two of us for sure.
Coming soon.
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining me for this conversation on the Mom Forum. And I hope that you were able to relate to some part of this story. Please join us over on social media on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at The Mom Forum, or come give us a visit on our site, themom-forum.com, to read our new blog posts, shop our products, or check out our next event. Thank you, and we will see you the next time on The Mom Forum.